It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the show, it's tempting to think of dolphins like the friendly, tail-wagging dogs of the ocean. But our guest says that stories about special human-dolphin relationships are probably overblown. We'll find out why.
First, when we talk about the Wisconsin economy, it's easy to take a one-size-fits-all approach. Either we're doing well or we're not, right? Well, our next guest says the answer isn't so clear-cut.
In a new report that covers 13 years of data crunched by the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, Wisconsin's divided into six distinct economic regions, each with different economic profiles.
Joining us now is Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Well, good to be back.
So, Todd, tell us about this. Why break Wisconsin down into six separate economic regions?
Well, we've been sort of amused the last couple of years as politicians on both sides of the aisle have been pulling monthly economic data, job statistics, often that were revised to mean something entirely different, and they were always focused on statewide numbers, and we thought it was important to take a longer view, so we go back to 2000, and to look at the state in pieces rather than as a whole. And it's quite striking when you do that, because what you find is that some regions are outperforming the state and are doing well compared to the nation, and others are lagging the state and losing ground.
So when we say something like jobs are up or jobs are down in Wisconsin, it doesn't tell the whole story. Where are we seeing the state doing well? What kind of regions?
Well, the two that are leading the pack are western Wisconsin. So the counties along the river running from, you know, Grant in the south all the way up to Polk in the north. And then the other region, which is actually the fastest growing one, are the counties, including Dane and surrounding Dane.
So that, I gather, is not a surprise. You've got the Capitol, a major research university. That one is a kind of a self-driving force, right?
Yeah, you'd expect the Madison area to do all right, because this includes two recessions, and of course, state government and the university are going to be a little less volatile during a recession than some industries. But what's interesting is that it's particularly the information technology sector that really stands out in terms of employment growth there. So it's about a lot more than just, you know, the things that we traditionally think of the Madison area as representing.
And western Wisconsin, I gather, was more of a surprise to economists.
Yeah, it was. And it's not that every county out there is doing spectacularly, but over the whole region, it looks pretty good. We've known for some time that St. Croix, Pierce counties, the counties that are commuter counties to the Twin Cities, had been doing rather well. But when you look at some of the other counties up and down the river, in terms of employment growth, it was second only to the greater Madison area, and its earnings and its incomes were growing faster than the state as a whole.
Now, on the downside, we have kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. Let's start in southeastern Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, I guess we'd call it the post-industrial part of the state.
Yeah. I mean, we're running from Walworth and Kenosha in the south to Sheboygan in the north and as far west as Jefferson County. Mm. And, yeah, this is where 40% of the jobs in the state are. It's historically had the highest average incomes, and yet it had the largest job losses, and in terms of earnings and income, at best it was keeping pace with the state, which was trailing the nation.
And that includes the suburban belt around Milwaukee.
That includes the suburban belt around Milwaukee. So, it truly is, you know, that urban southeast, which includes a significant part of the population, jobs, and historically wealth.
And also in decline, northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, and of course, this isn't as much of a surprise. For instance, school enrollments have been dropping throughout large parts of the North for many years, and it actually lost population. And its job loss was almost as large as Southeast Wisconsin. What was a little bit of a surprise to us was that in areas such as lodging and hospitality, the job losses were fairly noticeable, and you wouldn't expect that for this part of the state that we like to vacation in.
So in the middle of the pack, we had the Green Bay, Fox Cities was in a region, and then mm-hmm. Wausau and Central Wisconsin. Anything notable that struck you in either of those?
Well, the Fox Valley Northeast area is on the margin, doing a little better than the state. It had job growth over the last 13 years, while the state had slight job decline. It had more population growth than the state as a whole, and its manufacturing sector, which is an important one in Wisconsin since we're one of the leading manufacturing states, it probably held up better than in some other regions of the state. So the Fox Valley Northeast is, and we call it sort of the happy medium. Central Wisconsin is performing about on par with the rest of the state, so it's sort of it too is sort of middle of the pack, but it's certainly not setting the world on fire.
So, what are the lessons here? Now we've got these six regions mm-hmm. pulling in their own directions. If you're a state policymaker, what do you learn from this to try to boost the state overall and these regions in particular?
Well, I think before you pursue policy solutions, first of all, you've got to be watching the right things and asking the right questions. And lesson one is look at data over multiple economic cycles and data that are good and reliable and final, rather preliminary and speculative and last month subject to change. And the other is that there isn't such a thing as a Wisconsin economy, and so why do we focus on that in all our debate? And different areas of the state have different strengths. I mean, one of the messages of the South Central region is they lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, but they still outpaced the state. So there's an example to steal a phrase, creative destruction, where you're losing on the one hand, but you're more than making up for it on the other. And I think the lesson from the western part of the state is its growth is very broad-based. It's a diverse economy. There's some strength in dairy. There's some strength in mining. There's strength in healthcare, education. And that area held up better in terms of manufacturing than any other part of the state. So it was very much a diverse economy.
Todd, you mentioned at the outset basically both sides in state government are waving dueling job reports mm-hmm. at each other and just trying to make political hay out of them a lot of the time. Do you think that's going to change that, and that both sides might hunker down and try to get into the details and see what works?
Short answer is no. it's been going on for a couple years, and we were just hoping that, perhaps after the political season, people will have come to realize that they need to think long haul, and they need to think regionally, and one size does not fit all.
All right. Todd, thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
Lots of us are fascinated with dolphins, and there have been stories and legends of dolphins saving drowning humans for centuries that have helped increase that fascination.
But is there a special relationship between humans and dolphins? The author of a new book joins us now to tackle that question. Justin Gregg is a research associate with the Dolphin Communication Project. His new book is Are Dolphins Really Smart? And we've linked his recent article on the Central Time Facebook page. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
So first, what kind of beliefs are out there, true or not, about this idea of a dolphin-human bond?
Yeah, well, there's sort of a general belief that dolphins are extremely friendly and peaceful animals that have a long reputation, as you noted in the intro, of saving humans, rescuing them from shark attacks or if they're drowning, and that this finds its way into the sort of tourist industries based on swimming with dolphins.
There's a whole lot of stories like that out there, though. I mean, okay, I'll be upfront with you here. I love dolphins. I paid for the, you know, meet a dolphin thing at SeaWorld. I thought it was incredible. And, you know, this is sort of hard to hear. So how do you discount some of these stories? You know, one Rob and I were talking over in the office was Elian Gonzalez, who says that he was saved by dolphins.
Yeah, that's definitely a famous case. Oh, I don't discount them at all. In fact, there's a lot of great evidence in the scientific literature showing that the dolphins go out of their way to interact with human beings. They're these animals that fall in the category of lone sociable dolphins. These are dolphins that are sort of off by themselves, not spending too much time with other dolphins, and coming to the beaches and to the harbors just to interact with humans. But when it comes to those rescue stories, of course, you know, I also agree that they probably happen. Dolphins have a reputation with themselves for rescuing each other and helping each other. But the problem as a scientist is you always want to see the video. You want to see the data to confirm it. Otherwise, you have to sort of take it with a grain of salt. So I'm sure it happens, but I wish there were more data that we could look at to confirm exactly how it happened.
Well, are dolphins in the wild generally or always friendly to humans?
No, that's definitely not the case. There are actually 40-odd species of dolphins, and there are species like Cummerson's dolphins and Fraser's dolphins, which no one has really ever heard of because they rarely interact with humans at all. They live far out to sea. And then you have bottlenose dolphins, which live near where humans live on the coasts, and they interact with humans in a variety of different ways. Sometimes they're very friendly, like those lone sociable dolphins, but then sometimes these interactions are not always friendly. They have been known to attack and to bite people. So it's sort of a mixed bag of friendly and unfriendly behavior.
It seems like there are a handful of these swim with dolphin encounter programs around the world that obviously do pretty well for tourist sites. And it sounds like with these populations of dolphins, you know, you've got different categories, and some of them, the dolphins are acclimated to people first and deliberately so that they can be used in this way. And maybe in one or two cases, the dolphins themselves did prove friendly. So how do you sort out, you know, what's going on there?
Yeah, there are so many different situations that have sort of cropped up organically. Like you said, some dolphins have sought out the company of humans. Like in the Bahamas, you can swim with wild dolphin groups that seem quite interested in not all the time, but sometimes, in swimming with humans. And then in other cases, you have humans that have targeted dolphins and fed them food to try and get them interested in interacting with people. And everything else in between. You have dolphins swims out in Hawaii, for example, with spinner dolphins who are sometimes interested and sometimes not. And then, of course, you have dolphin swim programs in captivity, but that's it's hard to judge, of course, because they're not free to choose their own interactions. But in the wild, you have all sorts of different kinds of interactions that occur.
So do you think that the belief there's a special bond between humans and dolphins leads us to want to interact with dolphins in ways that are not good for the dolphins?
Yeah, that is one of the problems. I mean, there's good evidence to show that humans and dolphins do enjoy each other's company, but the sort of overarching belief that they really want to be with us can lead to some problems, of course. Humans will, you know, with these industries based on tourism, they'll go out with all these boats and try and swim with the dolphins, and that can be very disturbing for the dolphins, obviously. So that's not always a good thing. You have to be very careful with these tourist industries. But then also people will feed dolphins to try and get them to come closer to the boats so that they can pet them. And that's obviously a very bad thing for the dolphins. And a lot of dolphins that end up getting too close to humans in a general way, whether or not they're being fed or just hanging out near boats, end up injured or killed, sometimes by accident and sometimes on purpose. So it's just, in a general way, better for dolphins to sort of stay out doing their dolphin things and humans to do their human things. And not spend too much time together.
And you talked about the dolphins who are injured and killed. There were also some pretty surprising stories in your piece about humans getting injured. Now, there's only one incidence of a guy who got killed after his encounter with a dolphin. But just so we see the other side of this, can you tell a couple stories about some bad things that happened to people who interacted with dolphins?
Yeah, well, in generally, it's extremely rare to be injured by a dolphin at all. It almost never happens in all these encounters. But with those lone sociable dolphins that I was talking about before, those are the ones that they're kind of weird dolphins to begin with because they don't want to spend time with the dolphins. They want to spend time with people. And in a lot of those cases, and in fact, the majority of those cases, although they're social and interested in people, they do end up injuring people a lot of the time. Sometimes they'll drag them out to sea or pin them to the seafloor. Or bite them or ram them, breaking ribs and causing injuries. And there's a famous story of the only incident of a dolphin killing a human being in the wild was one of these lone sociable dolphins in Brazil, and a couple of guys who were apparently intoxicated were trying to restrain the dolphin and maybe even trying to shove a cigarette into the blowhole of the dolphin, which, as you can imagine, the dolphin did not enjoy at all and actually killed one of these swimmers.
So I think part of the fascination with dolphins, we always hear or often hear dolphins are the smartest thing out there or one of the smartest non-human animals in the world. Are they that intelligent? Are they one of our smartest peers on the planet?
Yeah, that's in my book, that's really what I'm investigating, this idea that they are one of the smartest or the second smartest or almost as smart as human beings. And of course, as a scientist, you say, well, you can't really rank animals that way. It's not really fair to create this scale of who's the smartest, with humans, of course, always being in the top. But you can look at all the things that dolphins do to see if they do behaviors that are complicated in the way that human behavior is complicated. And you find, yeah, actually, when it comes to social cognition, the complexity of their social societies, and some of the lab work they do with symbol comprehension, they're right up there with the great apes and sometimes different crow species in terms of complex things that they can do. But of course, we hear a lot of other things that they're supposedly really good at, which when you look at the science, isn't always the case.
Like what?
Well, people often say that dolphins have a communication system that's more complicated than other animals, that is a lot like human language. And when you sort of look at the way it works, yeah, it's definitely complicated, but it's probably not correct to consider it as complicated as human language. So that's often something you hear, which is a little bit overblown.
There's been a lot of attention lately on killer whales in captivity. The documentary Blackfish shined a light on that and has people wondering whether it's kind of ridiculous to have orcas in captivity because they can become neurotic and can kill people. Now, an orca is a lot bigger than a dolphin, but you're talking about another extremely intelligent form of marine life that is often used in sort of marine amusement parks. Is there a case like that to be made for dolphins in captivity, or do you think there's nothing wrong with that?
Well, the killer whales are actually dolphins. They're actually the largest of all dolphin species. You have to look at every different species and how it reacts or would react to different kinds of captivity. Every species is different. Some can handle being sort of isolated and away from groups, and other species, like, for example, meerkats, it would be really terrible to take a meerkat away and put it all by itself because they live in these complicated groups and they thrive in contact with each other. So when it comes to dolphins as well, you have to look to see whether or not you can replicate in captivity what they have in the wild and how that might impact their welfare and their well-being.
So, Justin, you've demystified some of the things that might fascinate people about dolphins, but you've devoted your career to studying them. What fascinates you about dolphins?
Exactly the same things that fascinate everyone else. I was really interested in dolphin communication system because I thought, wow, it might be a lot like language. So I spent my whole career sort of investigating to see how it worked. And this is often the way when you ask a simple question like, are dolphins intelligent or do they have a language, and you dedicate years of your life, you end up with all these murky details, and things aren't always as black and white as you think when they start out. So I still have the same fascination with dolphins that I've always had. It's just now I have all these extra details in my head about what kind of animals dolphins are, and it's not the same as when I started.
Have you ever had a dolphin encounter, in our last minute here that made you scratch your head and think maybe there is something special there?
Yeah, pretty much any time I've swum in the water with dolphins, it's like that. I mean, as a scientist, you try and remain calm and collected so you can analyze the data and observe the behavior. But pretty much every time I jump in the water to film dolphins, you always get this sort of tingly feeling because it's just really cool to be in the water with them because they're interested in you and they're looking at you, and it's a different experience than swimming with fish,
for example.
All right, Justin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was dolphin researcher Justin Gregg. We've got an article he wrote linked on the Central Time Facebook page, and his new book is titled, Are Dolphins Really Smart?
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about why some devastating diseases are being neglected when it comes to new drug and vaccine development.
First, a look at land ownership, a concept that we take for granted now, but it created revolutionary change throughout history.
Andrew Linkletter wrote a book that was just released. It's called Owning the Land, The Transforming History of Land Ownership. We'd set up this interview some time ago, but got the sad news that Andrew passed away recently. The topic is relevant today, though, and we're still going to go ahead and talk about the topic.
George Gibson is joining us in lieu of Andrew Linkletter. He's the publishing director of Bloomsbury Publishing and a longtime friend of Andrew, and he joins us now to talk about the book and its author. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Veronica. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, first off, let's talk about Andrew a little bit. Can you tell us who he was?
Well, Andrew is a remarkable man. He's an Englishman, I should say he was originally from Scotland, born in Scotland, but lived in England. He was an amateur historian, but one who I think had more original ideas than many professional academic historians. He had a particular fascination for the land. His book, the new book, is called Owning the Earth, The Transforming History of Land Ownership. But he's had a long fascination, a lifelong fascination for the intersection of people and the land. And I think it started in many ways in the house he lived in Kent, which was built in the 15th century. He, in his own historical detective work, determined that in fact one of the owners 500 years ago changed the whole structural nature of the house, and that reflected a change in that person's life, which he then traced back to the change in land ownership in 16th century in England, when peasants, and this former owner was clearly a peasant, had not been able to own land, but then gradually that changed. Obviously, prior to that, it had been the king and the lords who had owned all the land in England. But gradually, individuals like this man who owned this house started to take ownership of their land. They would enclose it. He owned sheep and started making more money when the land got enclosed, and then they were able to actually take ownership of the land and not only that, but then pass it on to their to following generations, and that's where land ownership actually started to take hold as a really powerful force in society.
So this is something that had been building for hundreds of years, and in the book, Owning the Earth, Andrew's idea is that the idea of individual exclusive ownership of land turned out, in his opinion, to be the most creative and at the same time the most destructive cultural force in history. Let's break that down a bit. Why do you think he thought it was the most creative force?
Well, the most creative force in the sense that it represented freedom, and you know, if you owned your own land, you were master of your own fate in a certain way. You could pass it on to succeeding generations. I once asked David McCullough, the great American historian, and this was relating to Andrew's previous book called Measuring America, which is about how America ended up with this curious system of weights and measurements, but also was very much about how the land in America had been laid out, that grid system, as you can see if you overfly the country from a plane. I once asked David, was owning land one of the primary instigators of the American Revolution as opposed to freedom? And David said, absolutely. Land was what drove those who were fighting for independence. That was what represented freedom to them. And so, you know, in that sense, you know, owning one's land, which is a relatively recent in the history of mankind, is a relatively recent phenomenon, was really it was creative. It was liberating. It gave people a freedom that they never had had before.
A lot of positive forces there, but on the other hand, you're talking about in the context of a war, and there's many a war that's been fought over just that, land ownership. Is that where the destructive element comes in?
Partly, but I think from Andrew's point of view, and I certainly understand his point, the truly destructive aspect of it was that it overrode, if you will, all sorts of native peoples who, up to that time, owned their land communally. If you think of the American Indians, they felt that they owned all of North America, but they didn't own it in an individual sense. They owned it communally, and so all sorts of native peoples, whether it's Aborigines in Australia or native peoples in Siberia or other places where land ownership has been extended to individuals, they have been pushed off their land, and their rights to the land have been forcibly taken away from them. And so in that sense, I think Andrew felt this was that was the truly destructive side of it.
Well, I know as one of the questions considered in the book is, are human beings just hardwired to want to possess things, to own things? And have we applied that as far as it would go to the earth? That seems kind of outrageous when you think about it in those terms.
Yes. Absolutely it does. I mean, we have applied it to the earth. So if you own your house, you think that you own the land on which your house exists, and you own everything underneath it. Those who were lucky enough to have oil discovered on their land made a lot of money. The fracking industry today, inevitably some of the land that they're finding gas on is owned by individuals, and some of them have made a great deal of money. Do they have a right to own that land as opposed to, it being owned by society at large? And by government. I mean, the United States owns a great deal of land. In fact, early on, right after the Revolution, one of the ways that Jefferson and other American leaders realized that they could actually make money to pay off the enormous debts of the Revolution was to sell land that the U.S. government took by eminent domain from native peoples. And so all sorts of land companies were set up, and they surveyed the land and measured it and registered it and then sold it to people. It was an enormous source of revenue for America.
Now, human beings are the dominant species on Earth, and I guess it begs the question, can we really own the Earth? A conservationist might say we're just custodians. Is that a tension, ownership versus caretaking?
Very much so. Those who own land think of it as theirs and want to exploit it as theirs and don't necessarily think of using their land in the common good. I mean, there are certainly those who do and those who have created great swaths of land that they've given to nature conservancies and things like that. So there have been plenty of people who have thought about conserving land and protecting it, but then there are plenty of others who exploit it for their own benefit and not necessarily for society. So there is definitely that tension.
In terms of the history of America, of the New World, there is, as you alluded to already, Native Americans were bemused by pilgrims showing up, Americans from the Old World, from Europe, and saying, waving around these pieces of paper claiming that they own the land. And Native Americans thought, that was kind of a ridiculous claim. And yet, our society in America is based on that land ownership in many ways. Does that mean that, that's the only way to play it these days? You have to have ownership of land to function?
I think you certainly... People today feel that land ownership is a central element and an aspirational one. I mean, people want to own their own house and thereby own the land on which their house sits. And back when the Pilgrims came here, they initially tried to establish a communal society, and it didn't work. And they, William Bradford and others realized early on that they needed to shift to an individual ownership society. That's what would drive it, if you will. The communal strategy and the protocol wasn't working. And that early tension with the natives, was very real. No question about it. But that also existed in other parts of the world. One of the beauties of Andrew's book, I think, is that he takes very much of a global approach to land ownership, so that he makes a bold claim, and it's one that I don't think anybody has ever made before, and that is different kinds of land ownership in different parts of the world led to different kinds of government. So that in America, the private ownership of land led directly to America's the need for laws and the need for government to support the right to own land, those privileges and rights, and that led directly to America's democracy. Whereas in other parts of the world, land ownership devolved in different ways that led to different kinds of government, and that it was actually the ownership of land that catalyzed the kind of government that took shape in different parts of the world.
Are there areas of the world where there is still a communalist approach taken to land ownership? If we put the conservation areas aside, are there places where it is a communal thing?
You know, there are certainly small groups of people, communal groups. I honestly don't know whether the Amish, for example, think of their land as communal or not, but they might well. I mean, and groups like that do exist in parts of the world. And there, of course, are native peoples, Aborigines, for example, who still live in Australia, and the Native Americans here still think of land, in a communal way. But I think that's pretty rare. And I think, across most of the earth, I'm sure that's true in Africa. I'm sure there are tribes in Africa that consider land still in a communal way. I've read stories of that. But I would say it's certainly and I hate to use the word civilized because that suggests other parts of the world aren't civilized, which is not the case. But in the built-up parts of the world, if you will, the industrialized parts of the world, I think private land ownership is still is the dominant form.
We're talking with George Gibson now about the history and evolution of land ownership in the world, and you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Do you think that this private ownership of land is still the model that we need to use going forward as the population grows? Will we need to rethink the way we divvy up the resources on land as well? You can also send email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation right after this break. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're picking up our conversation with George Gibson about land ownership, inspired by the book Owning the Earth by Andrew Linklater, who passed away after his book was completed. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Looking at the evolution of the way we think about holding land and owning land. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's take a caller now. We have Steve joining us in River Falls. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is a comment that was just made concerning the global approach to land ownership. And my understanding, I've been doing research on the country of Mongolia, the land there is entirely owned collectively, even in the Constitution. And because of the nomadic herders, the whole country is owned by the country, and they divide it up and use it as a common property. And I just wanted to, it's a very large country with millions of animals, and it's an interesting comment on collective or communal or ownership of land. It's actually working pretty well.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you for bringing that up. And George, what about Mongolia? Is that a model that the rest of the world could look to if they wanted to look at alternative ownership?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. And Andrew did not cover Mongolia in the book. Interestingly, for whatever it's worth, my wonderfully capable assistant spent 2 years in Mongolia in the Peace Corps teaching English to Mongolian people. And I will ask him after the show, and I'll send you an email.
All right. Steve, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate that. Now, one thing I know Andrew did write about is an American named Wolf Ladejinsky, and he changed the land ownership model in Asian countries, sort of paved the way for the emerging tiger economies there. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, he's a fascinating guy. And, in the wake of World War II, when obviously Japan and was in tatters, was sent to Japan as an advisor and came up with a new model of land ownership for the Japanese. It was more along Western lines, and it was a big driver of certainly the Japanese economy, which recovered remarkably quickly after World War II, given how devastated the country had been, and then was sort of expropriated to other South Asian countries as well. He's a fascinating guy that not that many people know about. And that was one of the joys of Andrew's book, is that while there are plenty of people you've heard about in it, in the story, from John Locke and Adam Smith and Karl Marx, people like that, who obviously everybody's aware of. But there are all sorts of people like William Petty, who was a 16th century surveyor, who was the first to really understand that land could be used for commercial purposes, i.e. there was a commercial element to owning one's land. It could redound to your personal benefit. He was the first really to really express that. And then someone like Wolf Ladezhinsky, who, you know, I bet you nobody in the street on the streets on the West would know about, and yet he was instrumental in paving the way for the recovery of Japan and for the South Asian economies as a whole in the wake of World War II.
All right, well, let's go back to the phones. David is joining us in Rhinelander. Hi, David.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. It was real important. My grandparents emigrated from Germany in the late 1890s, early 1900s. And, you know, part of the reason they came to this country was they had it in their heads that if they worked real hard and followed rules that everyone had to abide by, not just a hierarchy got to set the rules, but if you worked hard and followed rules, that you could acquire something that was yours, and that was very important to them, and they passed that down to my parents, and oddly enough, my mother, daughter-in-law, was real adamant about passing it down.
David, I think we're losing you there on the cell phone, but I think we got the gist of your comment there and about how precious that idea was of owning something, owning a piece of land to immigrants. Is that something Andrew addressed?
Very much so. I mean, the immigrant experience in America was you know, seminal, and America was really where private land ownership first took real flower. I mean, obviously the settlers, the original settlers coming over, many of them were immigrants from England, and then of course other countries followed suit, and you got enormous German presence and Scandinavian presence, and so many different nationalities came to this country, and they were driven here, or they were inspired to come here by the opportunity to own land. No question about it. You know, there's a difference between between land ownership and private property. You could claim that a car is private property. Certainly an insurance company would claim a car was private property, or an apartment, or a piece of clothing. And so there's a difference between that kind of private property and real estate. It's interesting the word real estate, where it comes from, real estate being land. You know, you own a piece of real estate. It's real. There's nothing chimerical about it. It is substantive. And that term didn't exist before. I think it was the 17th century that it first came into usage, and it has been in use ever since.
And I suppose the reason that owning land is so valuable isn't just the land, although there's something about feeling like you own a patch of the earth, but it's the resources on the land.
The resources, yes. But I think for most people it's not necessarily the resources, you know, the oil or the ore or something like that on the land, or even the trees, but it's the value of that property to somebody, to themselves, and then the opportunity to increase that value, whether it's by building a house or doing something else to the land that will increase its value and then pass it on, you know, to future generations, or to use it in some kind of leveraged way. You know, that would be the more modern approach to land ownership. Certainly back when it was new, and when the settlers came to America, it was really just about owning their piece of the world. And it was a very emotional connection to owning something that they could consider theirs when they didn't have a whole lot else. But this piece of land was theirs.
And let's take another phone call right now. Eugene is with us in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon. I wonder if your guest could comment on the Dawes Act that was disastrous for the 1887 Dawes Act, where they split up the reservations. All the Indians, the Native Americans, believed you owned the land in common. And they passed that Dawes Act in 1887, where each member of the tribe got so many acres, and they sold off the rest of it to land speculators. And it was disastrous for Native Americans. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call, Eugene. Do you know about the Dawes Act?
Well, yeah, and it was absolutely devastating to Native Americans. The Native Americans always assumed that they owned land communally and felt they were entitled to the entire North American continent. I mean, there was, if you go back a long way, there were way more Native Americans than there were Anglo people on this continent, and gradually, you know, the Indians got pushed off their land and pushed onto reservations, and so the Dawes Act was kind of the end point of that, after the Trail of Tears and after, you know, Little Bighorn and other disastrous events for Native Americans, you know, the Dawes Act kind of put the nail in the coffin, if you will, of communal ownership of land, so that Indians were forced to, or Native Americans, I should say, were forced to own their own little piece of land, as opposed to, you know, sharing land amongst them, which is antithetical to their way of life.
Now, looking forward, there are estimates that by the year 2050, Earth will be home to 9 billion human beings. And that raises basic questions about shelter for people and clothes on people's back and food in people's mouths. And these are resources that have to come from planet Earth. So looking at that number, 9 billion, is there a fundamental change in the way land is owned that's needed for that number to accommodate everyone?
Yeah, I think Andrew certainly felt there was, and his research felt there was, and that that if we are going to be able to, you know, feed and clothe, as you say, that many people, we are going to have to adopt a more communally oriented approach to land, i.e., it needs to serve the people as a whole, rather than just individuals. The Earth will not perhaps be able to sustain, 9 billion individuals. It will need to, you know, whether it's food creation, if you will, or other aspects that would relate to the land. We're going to need to adopt a more communal approach to land to be able to, as a society, and if you think of the world as one society, be able to sustain it.
And did Andrew have ideas for what that sort of communal ownership would look like going forward? It seems like, you know, something that would be a hard sell, at least in America.
I think it's going to be a very hard sell. And you know, you think of all the other problems that we have to solve. And you know, this is a sort of intellectual problem as much as it is a physical one, if you know what I mean, or an economic one, to get people to think more societally, if you will. We are a very selfish people, a very self-indulgent people. Certainly in the West we are. I think other societies, in other parts of the world, may more naturally think communally. But we in the West certainly do not. And so you're absolutely right. It'll be a very hard sell, in the West. It's going to be one of those great challenges going forward. And who knows whether in fact, it'll be the communal approach that sustains 9 billion people, or we improve technologies enough so that we can do so. One doesn't know that going forward, but selling the idea of a more communal approach to land and land ownership will be a very difficult thing in the West.
All right. Well, George, I want to thank you so much for being willing to come on today and talk about your friend Andrew Linklater's book. We appreciate that.
No, thank you very much. You've got a wonderful show. Really do.
Oh, thank you so much. We've been talking to George Gibson, the longtime friend of Andrew Linklater, who before his recent death authored the book Owning the Earth, A Transforming History of Land Ownership.